From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty years ago today, the Supreme Court legalized abortion with the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. On this anniversary, President Clinton has lifted bans on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics, on fetal tissue research, and on abortions at military hospitals overseas. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with leaders in the anti-abortion and the abortion rights movements. We'll talk with a nurse who headed a healthcare center that provides abortions, a surgeon who co-founded National Right to Life, the lawyer who recently argued in the Supreme Court against abortion restrictions, and a lawyer who represents the Catholic Church. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Zoe Baird, President Clinton's nominee for Attorney General, bowed to mounting opposition and asked that her name be withdrawn. In a late-night letter to the president, Baird said the continuing controversy over her hiring of illegal immigrants to do household work would impede her ability to reinvigorate the Justice Department. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Baird's withdrawal came after the Democratic Senate leadership informed the White House that President Clinton would have to use all his political capital if he wanted to save his nominee, and that even then, victory could not be assured. Public reaction to the hiring of the illegal immigrants had been overwhelming, with Senate offices swamped with opposition calls and almost no supporting calls. Mr. Clinton's political advisors told him that he could only lose in this situation. As one put it, a nanny problem is not a great populist issue. With nominee Baird out of the picture now, the focus turns to the Justice Department and who will run it. Women's groups are pressing the president to name another woman, but White House officials said they would cast a broader net this time, and in the meantime, holdover Republicans are running the Justice Department. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Capitol.
House Banking Chairman Henry Gonzalez called on President Clinton today to hand over documents on a banking scandal involving Iraq. The Texas Democrat sent a letter to the president asking for material that had been denied by the Bush administration. Gonzalez has led a 2.5-year investigation into charges that the Bush administration gave Iraq favorable treatment before the Gulf War, then tried to conceal that treatment. The allegations said the Bush administration intervened improperly in an Atlanta bank scandal involving Iraqi abuse of U.S. funds. Hundreds of thousands of people in western Washington have been told they may have to wait until next week to get their electricity back. Meanwhile, state and local officials are busy assessing the damage left from Wednesday's violent windstorm. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports.
Utility officials say there's no way they can predict which households and businesses will be reconnected today and which will have to suffer through the weekend and into next week without power. Washington's governor has declared a state of emergency, and work crews from across the western U.S. and Canada are providing backup generators, food, and assistance to cold, tired residents. Insurance companies are being flooded with damage claims, and Washington's insurance commissioner is touring hard-hit areas today by helicopter. Also today, individual counties are expected to release damage estimates, sure to total in the millions of dollars. Winds gusted above 90 miles an hour on Wednesday, killing 9 people in Washington and Idaho. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,256.8. This is NPR News. President Clinton signed orders today lifting Bush administration bans on a number of activities related to abortion. In keeping with his campaign promise, the president removed restrictions on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics and lifted a ban on research using fetal tissue from induced abortions. On the 20th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion, anti-abortion protesters were out in Dallas today. The city's the home of Norma McCorvey, who, as Jane Roe, was the subject of the 1973 case. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA reports.
Standing in front of the Fairmont Clinic, abortion rights foes were out early in Dallas. They are here every weekend, but usually with about half this morning's 40 or so protesters. With the new Clinton administration favoring abortion rights positions the Reagan and Bush administrations opposed, protesters are focusing efforts more on state rather than federal legislation. But one marcher, Carol Rhodes, hasn't given up on changing President Clinton's mind.
And we're backing our president because we believe as Christians that God, he wouldn't be there if the Lord didn't place him there. That the Lord will convict his heart that abortion is wrong.
Anti-abortion and abortion rights demonstrations are scheduled throughout the day in Dallas and the rest of the state. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Anti-abortion activists also held their annual rally in Washington, D.C. today to mark the anniversary. There was new fighting in Croatia today as Croats attacked Serbian areas near the Adriatic coast that are under UN protection. It was the first serious violation of the ceasefire in the former Yugoslav Republic in the past year. The president of Yugoslavia condemned the attacks and said they could reignite the Croatian civil war. The UN Security Council issued a non-binding statement saying it deplored the Croatian army offensive and calling on the Croats to withdraw. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that guaranteed a woman's right to abortion. President Clinton used the occasion to lift the restrictions on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics. He also lifted bans on fetal tissue research and abortion in military hospitals overseas. He's reviewing the importation ban on the abortion pill RU486. We'll be hearing from activists who support and oppose abortion rights. Jean Hunt has been active in the women's health movement since the late 60s. She's a registered nurse. From 1988 to 92, she directed the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia, which provides abortions. She applauds the president for the executive orders he issued today. I asked her to think back 20 years to the day abortion was legalized.
When the decision came in, I was thrilled. I was overjoyed that we had won what seemed like a monumental victory, and very much out of my own personal history. I came to the age of sexual activity in the 50s and the 60s, and it was a time of terror for me as a young person, even though I was middle class. And I never shook that terror, really, until 1973. Never felt comfortable in my body. The other thing that happened, though, was that a friend of mine, Rachel Fruchter, who was an activist in the movement in New York, said to us at that time, "We're going to rue the day that we won this victory through the Supreme Court." And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I said, "What are you talking about, Rachel? We've won." She said, "We didn't win by building a movement state by state that demanded this. We didn't do the work that we needed to do to win this. It was handed to us." And she was right.
I'm sure a lot of women who support the right to abortion feel that the battle might be kind of won now, in the sense that the Supreme Court has decided not to overturn Roe v. Wade, and there's a pro-choice president now, President Clinton. Do you feel that that the battle is won, that the battle is over?
Well, let me say a couple things about this, Terry. First of all, this is a battle. It is about women, but it's also about families, and families have women and men in them. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we've won something by the court's decision on the Pennsylvania case. We've won a basic affirmation, and the court gave some very good language, which I know Kitty Colbert has talked to you about our right to bodily integrity. But at the same time, the court has the rule that we say is it's never met a regulation it didn't like around abortion. And the reality of these regulations is that they are designed to drive providers out of the business of providing abortion services. And I think what people have to understand is that even if we win the legal right, and even if we have a positive regulatory climate in Washington, the medical service of abortion has vanished from the American medical system, and that the anti-abortion movement has won an enormous victory, and it's a done deed unless we right now reverse that trend. And that is much more disturbing to me, because what it means is that the range of healthcare services we need as women in order to stay healthy and to be able to have the children that we want to have is not there.
So abortion remains legal, but it's really difficult to get.
In 83% of the counties of the United States, there is no abortion provider. So the legal right is an empty victory. It's a hollow victory if you live in a county where there is no one who can provide the service for you in a safe and legal manner.
Are there fewer doctors performing abortion now than there were a few years ago?
There are many fewer doctors performing abortion, and abortion has increasingly become a segregated service, a segregated medical service. It now exists on the far edges of the healthcare system, as if it had nothing to do with anything else having to do with women's healthcare. There are almost no physicians routinely getting trained in OBGYN residencies. I believe the figure is 12% of OBGYN residencies mandate training in abortion procedures for students going through those residencies. When I came to Blackwell in the fall of 1988, we had four physicians working with us providing abortion services. In the late fall of 1988, I fired one of them. He had excellent technical skills, but had poor attitudes about women, and we felt that he was not respectful enough of the women coming through the center. I regretted firing him very much in a very short period of time because we no longer had the luxury to demand that attitude be a category by which we measure physicians. We were lucky to get physicians with good technical skills, which was the bottom line.
What's the problem? Why are there so few doctors performing abortion now?
I think it's a very complex problem. I think the most obvious piece of it is that physicians are afraid. In many, many communities, they are targeted by a very small number of residents of that community, and their lives can be made miserable, as are the lives of their children, their spouses, their friends, and their families. So that the first thing is that the perception is, and in many towns the reality is, that if you're going to do abortion, you have to be willing to stand up and take a lot of heat. We on the pro-choice side, on the other hand, have not supported physicians who do abortions. We have not gone out of our way to say thank you for providing this piece of women's health care to the physicians that we see. We don't ask our gynecologists, do you provide abortion services? And if you don't, why don't you? We don't choose our gynecologists on the basis of this. The anti-abortion movement has been doing this for now for 20 years.
In your experience, during the 4 years that you headed the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women, did you see doctors who performed abortions harassed? And were you personally harassed for heading the center?
Oh, I was harassed extensively, and the center was harassed extensively. All of us, not just the executive director and the physicians, but the counselors, the lab techs, the students who work with us on weekends, all of us faced tremendous. There were smoke bombs, there were bomb threats, there were letters coming in on a regular basis telling us that we were going to die, our families were going to die.
I want to get back to the difficulty that you had hiring a doctor to replace the doctor that you fired. What was the problem and how did you go about finding someone?
Well, I'll tell you some of the things that I did. I sent personal letters to every graduating OBGYN resident of three local medical schools in Philadelphia outlining the problem, explaining that if they were pro-choice, they might consider working with us on a part-time basis, begging them for help. I got not one response. I spoke at Grand Rounds and directly to OBGYN residents at several medical schools. I spoke to the heads of OBGYN departments at several medical schools in the region asking for assistance. Got nowhere. I ran ads in the New York Times. I ran ads in the Inquirer. I got one response in the New York Times from a physician who, when he found out that I wanted to do a credentialing process, explore his credentials and his capability, he dropped out immediately. He clearly thought that just because I ran an abortion facility, I'd be willing to take any old anybody into the center, which was never the case and never will be the case.
Did you find someone?
No.
Really?
No.
So you're down one.
We're down to two physicians. And we worry very much that if either of them leaves, we would not be able to replace them.
My guest is Jean Hunt, former director of the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Healthcare activist Jean Hunt is my guest. The center that you directed for 4 years was the target of many anti-abortion demonstrations. I'd like you to describe one of those demonstrations, one of the more dramatic ones, in which you tried to keep the healthcare center open, to keep services operating, in spite of the protests.
They almost always would come without warning. So that we would arrive at the center, or workers would arrive at the center and find that the doors were blockaded. The police historically are very slow at clearing the center. It would sometimes take 2 to 3 hours. It seemed to me that most of these protests took place on freezing cold days in the driving rain. The center staff would be out on the street through that whole process. Many of the anti-abortion demonstrators are really kind of unhinged. There's something in them, I don't exactly understand it, why a grown man would fall to his knees weeping to a 22-year-old woman, "Mommy, mommy, don't murder me, mommy." There's some loss of boundary here that doesn't make much sense to me. There was a very unpleasant racial dynamic. The protesters were almost always white. Most of them, we know from doing a study, were from outside of Philadelphia. Many of the women coming to our center were Black and Hispanic. The men accompanying their women, their wives, or their girlfriends into the center were very often the targets of quite racist attacks. "Be a real man. You're not a real man. If you were a real man, you'd raise up your child." It always was amazing to me that families did not respond with violence to these very violent and provocative attacks upon their personhood and their dignity. When we would finally get the center open, what people don't understand is that then the day begins for the center staff. And then you have a group of very angry and very upset consumers that are there for a service, all determined to go forward with it. Anybody that gets turned away during a blockade who doesn't come in that day, our experience was almost always they would come back the next day or the next available appointment. Nobody's mind was ever changed in any kind of permanent way because they would go back to their lives. And they would go back into the situation which led them to make this decision in the first place.
Now, the center that you headed is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania restrictive abortion law was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1992. How did that law affect you?
Well, the law hasn't yet been implemented. But if it was implemented, we're very concerned about our future ability to provide care for a couple of reasons. One was that the law mandated that physicians have to do the counseling for abortions, and we're having trouble getting physicians to come in and do the surgery. Physicians are historically not great counselors. When you go through medical school, you don't learn a lot about how to do counseling. So there were two problems with this. One is that we would have to find a physician willing to come in and do the counseling and pay him or her a very high, you know, amount of money to get them to do this piece, which they weren't that interested in doing. And then we would have to turn around and do the counseling again to be sure that women were adequately counseled and adequately listened to. So that was going to create a tremendous both administrative and financial burden for us. And I tried to cost it out a number of times. I never could really do it because I wasn't exactly sure what the final regulations would look like. But I knew that it was going to dramatically increase the cost of the procedure. Likewise, on the 24-hour wait, it was going to add a lot of administrative and bureaucratic detail to our functioning, which wasn't going to guarantee better health for women or better services for women. It was really designed to be an obstacle. Again, it would drive up costs and make it much more difficult for us to take care of the same number of women, which is what I think it was intended to do.
I want to paraphrase something that you recently said. You said that you're tired of people who see the middle ground on the abortion issue as being this, that abortion remains legal, but it's very, very difficult to get.
I think the middle ground on the abortion question and where we ought to be moving is to make abortion absolutely available and accessible and then cut down the need for it. To me, it makes much more sense rather than to create a right and say, here it is, but you have to swim through sharks and jump over barbed wire fences to get this right. Let's make it possible for women not to need it. We do more abortions in this country than in any other industrialized nation of the world. There is no reason that we should be doing this many, and we only do it because of the failure of our public health care system to adequately address women's health care needs. And this is one area where I think we in the anti-abortion movement ought to join forces.
You had to deal with the business end of abortion. What were some of the problems you ran up against heading the Women's Health Care Center in balancing the books?
Well, as a nonprofit health care center which focused on providing extensive counseling and support to women, there were a lot of services we provided that nobody will pay for. You know, when you get paid for an abortion by Blue Cross or by an HMO, there's no money in that for counseling. There's money for the physician, there's money for the lab tests, there's money for the lights and the heat and the medical supplies, but that's it. we see abortion as, we see it as a broader problem than just a surgical intervention in someone's life. We see it as something where people need counseling and support. They need post-abortion care. They need access to family planning services. They may raise other questions in the course of their care which require social services intervention. So there was no funding for any of that.
Have a lot of abortion clinics been forced to close because of financial problems?
Yes, I think that over even in the time that I was at Blackwell, clinics were closing and physicians were going out of practice. And one of the major things is that physicians who came into this in the early 70s and began to do abortions did it because what they saw when they were residents, when abortion was illegal. A lot of the physicians who came to providing the service came to it out of a real drive that this shouldn't have to happen to women. Those physicians are gray and they're retiring. And they struggle to find young physicians who want to learn what they have to teach, and they can't find them. That's the first and major problem. The second is that a lot of pieces of what is required, for instance, insurance regulations, et cetera, insurance companies are increasingly less and less willing to insure us. Our insurance rates go up. So this whole combination, this whole package, combined with the day-to-day harassment of the staff by anti-abortion people and the fear that comes sometimes, makes you have to be pretty dedicated in order to hang in there.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jean Hunt is a healthcare consultant and the former director of the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. The Roe v. Wade ruling 20 years ago turned my next guest, Dr. Mildred Jefferson, into an activist. She's former president of the National Right to Life Committee and current president of Right to Life Crusade. Dr. Jefferson is a general surgeon with Boston University Medical Center and an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Boston University School of Medicine. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from Harvard Medical School. This is her most vivid memory of 20 years ago, the day a woman's right to abortion was guaranteed by the Supreme Court.
I remember very well what I was doing. I was actually playing with my dogs. And my father, who is now dead, told me that he had heard news on the radio that he simply could not believe. My father was a Methodist minister who had never in his entire life mentioned the word abortion to me. And he said, if he heard it correctly, the United States Supreme Court had made abortion the law of the land. And he could not believe that.
Let me just ask you the year that you co-founded Right to Life.
It was 1973. National Right to Life Committee came into being as a national organization in June of 1973 in Detroit. Almost all Right to Life activity in the United States has come about as a response to pro-abortion promotion. And I emphasize Right to Life because as you led in, you mentioned anti-abortion movement. I am not an anti-abortionist. I am a defender of the right to life and a defender of the sanctity of life and the Judeo-Christian ethical and moral tradition as the basis of the laws and customs of our country.
Now that Bill Clinton is the president and Bill Clinton is pro-choice, how does that affect the direction of your group, the Right to Life Crusade, and the tactics that your group will use?
It will not change the tactic of Right to Life Crusade, because we have understood from the very beginning that the White House was the forum that had to be protected. And it is because many parts of the rest of the movement did not see it in quite the same importance that we don't have it today. However, I would hope the one change that might be possible is taking advantage of what the new chief of staff, McLarty, had to say about creating access for all points of view. So far, there has not been any sign that I can see that there is an understanding that there is another point of view. Throughout the presidential campaign, even though Right to Life protesters appeared everywhere candidate Clinton appeared, that was not covered in the news. So it's unlikely that he himself was aware of how consistently there was the attempt to get the message across.
There are many doctors who perform abortions who have been harassed, and who have been harassed even by death threats. And these kinds of threats have driven many doctors away from performing abortions and have prevented many doctors from starting it in the first place. As a doctor yourself, do you approve of tactics that threaten doctors with their lives?
There is no evidence of any kind that I have seen or heard credible that has tied anyone in the Right to Life movement with any death threat to a doctor. That's contrary to anything that would be done from the Right to Life movement. However, when you consider what business abortion is and the fact that there may be not only commercial competitions but underworld ties, I think they lead to look in a different direction. The Right to Life movement has very active people who in the direct action movement, and they do go, shall we say, to very direct action and trying to let those doctors who do abortion know that they object and are trying to save the lives of those children.
I myself recommend
and would draw the line at anything that would look as if the individual was in any way endangered. And I don't believe that anyone in the Right to Life movement would act to the point of endangering any individual.
One of the tactics of demonstrators who have tried to prevent women from entering abortion clinics is to smoke bomb the clinics, stink bomb the clinics, and to surround the clinics so that women wanting abortions can't enter.
I don't know of any of the direct action movements of the Right to Life movement carrying on that kind of tactic. And I would suggest that if you can ever find out who has done these things, you're going to find something like the situation in California, where it was someone from the pro-abortion side attempting to discredit the pro-life direct activists in that gesture. The Operation Rescue adherents are the ones who are placing their bodies on the ground in front of the clinic doors. They are the ones who are chained by the kryptonite locks to those vehicles that are blocking the roads to the clinic. They are the ones in danger of their lives, and many of them have been injured by rough handling of those who are trying to get them out of the way.
Many doctors have spoken of how they saw the damages of illegal abortions, and that convinced them of the necessity of safe, legal abortion. I'm wondering if you've seen that during your medical career and what effect it's had on you.
Well, I wish the same doctors would follow the patients that are being operated on now under the so-called legal auspices and see how happy they would be then with today's circumstance. Because when you consider 4,400 women undergoing abortion every single day in this country, you know that they are not getting the kind of medical care and supervision they need. They're not getting the kind of follow-up they need. We are creating a generation of gynecologic cripples, and they are closing their eyes to this. I've always heard the experience quoted by the people you're referring to, and I found that they tended to greatly exaggerate the complications of the procedures that they referred to as, quote, illegal, and they have greatly minimized the deaths and complications that occur now. I don't find that a suitable way of evaluating medical and surgical circumstances.
Dr. Mildred Jefferson is president of Right to Life Crusade and a surgeon with Boston University Medical Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on abortion in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's the 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that guaranteed a woman's right to abortion. President Clinton today lifted several abortion restrictions imposed under the Reagan and Bush administrations. We can expect to see new legal strategies from both sides of the abortion issue. Coming up, we'll hear from Catherine Colbert, the lawyer who recently challenged state abortion restrictions before the Supreme Court. And we'll hear from Helen Alvarez, a lawyer who represents the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. On the 20th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion, President Bill Clinton has issued a series of orders overturning abortion restrictions put in place by the Reagan and Bush administrations. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
As 75,000 anti-abortion protesters rallied near the White House, President Clinton signed an order ending the so-called gag rule, the ban on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics. And he ended a prohibition on research involving fetal tissue. He had promised both those actions during the campaign. Today, he also signed a directive ending a ban on abortions at military hospitals overseas. He restored federal funding for overseas family planning programs, and he ordered a review of the ban on the private importation of the French abortion pill RU486. President Clinton said that the Reagan and Bush restrictions had interfered with medical science and with the doctor-patient relationship. In addition to the five abortion memoranda, Vice President Gore announced that President Clinton had also abolished the White House Competitiveness Council. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton held his first cabinet meeting today, that after 13 cabinet members were sworn in during a White House ceremony by Chief Justice William Rehnquist. But the post of Attorney General is still vacant, and it will be until the president comes up with a nominee to replace Zoe Baird. She withdrew overnight after widespread opposition to her nomination when it became known she had hired illegal immigrants to do housework. Mr. Clinton said he's sad about that, but will waste no time beginning the search for a replacement. Congressional Democrats are moving quickly to enact family leave legislation that has been stalled on Capitol Hill and blocked by the White House for more than a decade. Today, the Senate took up the measure. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Testifying on the bill today, Labor Secretary Robert Reich said its passage would signal a turning point in the history of American workforce policy. President Clinton campaigned on the issue, saying that President Bush refused to do what 72 other countries required by law. Mr. Bush vetoed the bill twice, saying it was too onerous on small businesses, even though it exempted companies with less than 50 employees. Reich disputed that argument today, noting that less than half the workforce would be covered and 95% of companies fall under the exemption. Reich says it will make U.S. companies more competitive by improving morale and encouraging worker loyalty. Democrats aim to send the bill quickly to President Clinton as a symbol of an end to congressional gridlock. Republicans say the measure has widespread support, but others won't be as easy to pass. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials rose 4 points to end the day at 3257. Trading today was heavy. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. For the second day in a row, an American warplane has fired on an Iraqi radar site. The Pentagon says the U.S. Air Force jet fired two high-speed anti-radiation missiles at the site after Iraqi radar locked onto the American plane. It was one of two jets on a routine monitoring mission over the northern no-fly zone. No word on damage to the missile site, but both planes returned safely. Croatian troops crossed into United Nations-administered territory in the former Yugoslavia today, prompting fears of renewed hostilities with Serbia. The moves by Croatia were quickly denounced by the UN Security Council. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The offensive took place inside one of the so-called pink zones, parts of Croatia that are disputed by Serbs. The areas are supposed to have been demilitarized and placed under UN control, but Croatia has complained that the UN has allowed local Serbs to form militias there. Today, Croatian artillery units and tanks crossed into parts of a zone and briefly clashed with Serbs. Some casualties were reported. Croatian officials at the UN said the troops were sent to the area to stabilize it while the government rebuilt an important bridge, but the move was denounced by the Security Council, which demanded that Croatia pull its troops back. The incident jeopardizes the fragile ceasefire that now exists between Croatia and Serbia. Belgrade officials warned that they may send troops into the region if Croatia does not end the offensive. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Meanwhile, a team of UN investigators has reportedly found a mass grave containing as many as 200 bodies. A spokesman says it's thought the victims were executed by Serb troops. A U.S. military official says a Somali youth was shot and killed at a U.S. Marine compound in northern Mogadishu, that after he threatened a sentry with a pistol. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On this 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, President Clinton has lifted restrictions on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics and bans on fetal tissue research and abortions at military hospitals overseas. He's reviewing the ban on importation of the abortion pill RU486. The Supreme Court recently upheld state restrictions limiting access to abortion. My guest is the lawyer who asked the Supreme Court to overturn the restrictive Pennsylvania abortion law and lost. Catherine Colbert had previously won a similar case before the Supreme Court. Colbert is vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. Now, with a pro-choice president who has lifted several abortion restrictions, does she think the abortion rights struggle has been won?
No, our fight is just beginning. I think it is very clear to me. In fact, we have, at the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, have just completed an in-depth look at the federal law in this area, that Reagan and Bush were extraordinarily successful at influencing policy in many, many more ways than we ever imagined. If you take a look at the federal statutes, they are full of policy decisions that favor childbirth over abortion, that discourage women's choice of abortion, that make it more difficult for her to exercise a range of reproductive choices. And therefore, I think while it took 12 years to institute those policies, it's going to be at least 4 to undo them.
When the Supreme Court upheld the Pennsylvania restrictive abortion law, it gave other states an open door to create restrictions on abortion rights there. Do you foresee in the next few years that we'll see a lot of states coming up with their own restrictive abortion laws?
I do. And in fact, this year I think will be one of the worst years we've seen at the state legislative level because the Supreme Court has given states license to restrict in the way that they first restricted in Pennsylvania, waiting periods, bias counseling, restrictions on second trimester hospitalization, restrictions on, the heights of windows and doors and all kinds of ways that sound reasonable on their face but actually impede women's ability to obtain abortions. And this year, I think, because the Supreme Court has sanctioned some burdens on women, that is anything that's not what the court called undue, will mean that state legislatures will act in this area, and I think we're going to lose a lot of those fights. My preliminary estimate goes somewhere between 10 and 12 states will pass a new restriction on women in the coming year.
Since the Supreme Court upheld restrictions on access to abortion, how are you going to go about fighting those restrictions?
Well, that's a very difficult job, and that's, in many ways underscores the importance of the Supreme Court, even in a Clinton era that's supportive. That is, the Supreme Court has said it's all right to restrict. I think we need to go back to states and talk to state legislatures about what these laws really do. Let me give you an example. There's only one state in the country right now that has waiting periods in effect. That's the state of Mississippi. The Mississippi law went into effect in August. Within 3 weeks of the restriction going into effect, the number of abortions performed within Mississippi dropped by over 50%. This is what legislators need to know, that it will have an effect on women seeking abortions. Now, the waiting period didn't change women's minds. That is, that 50% drop is not because they had an extra 24 hours to think about the decision. It was caused directly by the restriction, and those same women were forced to seek abortions out of state or be prevented from obtaining the procedure altogether. And let me explain how that works. A waiting period sounds great, right? Oh, if women ought to think about these things first. But the reality is women do think about this decision before ever contacting clinics. They often know completely that they want this decision, that they want this procedure. But in Mississippi, there's only 3 abortion providers for the entire state. And many women have to travel somewhere up to 200 miles to get to that provider. The waiting period forces them to go to the provider and come back at least 3 or 4 days later, sometimes as long as a week to 10 days later, because the providers don't, in fact, perform abortions every day of the week. So what sounds very simple, like all women ought to make informed choices, really has turned into a complete obstacle for many women obtaining the procedure.
The obstacle is it takes more time and it costs more money.
Well, it costs a tremendous amount more money because they're talking about 2 trips of 200 miles to a clinic. You have to take off time from work. You have to get arrange for child care. Sometimes you have to stay overnight in a hotel if you're lucky enough to have a back-to-back appointment. So all of those things contribute to the increased cost. And it also discourages women from exercising the choice that they think is appropriate for them.
Now, what about the availability of clinics? Some clinics went out of business because of the harassment.
That's right.
So what legal recourse do you have to that?
Well, there's, again, a variety of options. Since the Supreme Court issued the Bray decision last week, the most effective remedy, legal remedy, has been taken away. That is, going into federal court and seeking injunctions under the federal civil rights statutes. But I think we can do a number of things. One is we can introduce federal legislation that will create a private right of action and a statutory remedy in federal law.
But what does that mean?
Well, it would mean that you have a federal right by statute to go into court and seek an order against clinic blockades. That would give jurisdiction to federal courts. It would permit federal courts to use the federal marshals. We also, with a new administration, can ask them to begin to enforce existing civil rights laws that were never used in the past because it required the Attorney General to take action. For example, the corollary of 1985-3, which was the subject of the Bray decision, is a federal statute that would permit the Justice Department to come in and prosecute for criminal activity when there's a violation of civil rights, and we would urge the Justice Department to do that. The second, the other area in the violence area that I think is absolutely critical is we have to demand that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the premier law enforcement agency in this nation, begin to track down the criminals who are harassing women outside of clinics. 12 years of inaction by the Reagan and Bush administration made us think that the federal government couldn't do this. But in fact, the FBI does have jurisdiction. They could tomorrow say we're setting up a special strike force and we're going to track down the people who are bombing clinics and who are committing arson and who are implementing chemical attacks. And it seems to me that's a very important change that could be implemented with just a phone call from the White House.
Now, I'm sure that there will be changes within your opposition. Changes in the anti-abortion movement. Do you know what those changes would be, and do you already have a plan of action to meet the changes in your opposition?
We certainly do have a plan of action, and I think it will reflect that. I think the first and foremost is when our opposition is feeling politically disempowered, there will be an increase in violence and intimidation and harassment. And I think particularly given the Supreme Court's action in the Bray case last week, the likelihood of that increase in violence is very strong. So it seems to me one of our first priorities is to, again, put pressure on the federal government to change the policies in this area and begin to investigate in a much stronger way the level of harassment and intimidation. On the other hand, the same movement is in what I see to be a very stealth move, beginning to infiltrate
the school boards to work at the state legislative level around education reform. And it seems to me there's a lot to be done at looking at the kinds of policy changes they're pushing at that level. That means, for example, issues like sex education in the schools, use of condoms in the schools, how we treat sexually transmitted diseases at the educational level and through state policy will all be the focus of the right.
Catherine Colbert, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Catherine Colbert is vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy in New York. We'll hear from a lawyer with the Catholic Church after the short break. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton's executive orders lifting abortion restrictions were bad news for my guest, Helen Alvarez. She's the director of planning and information for pro-life activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. She's a lawyer who formerly worked in the Office of General Counsel for the United States Catholic Conference. I asked her if she thinks the anti-abortion movement will change its strategy under President Clinton.
Well, I see the church, along with the pro-life movement generally, shifting some of its resources from the legislative arena to the educational arena. Now, we've always had three programs, pastoral, educational, legislative, and we have the pro-life movement over the country, over 3,000 crisis pregnancy centers. You're going to see even more of them opening because there's going to be even greater effort to address the problems that are sending women to the clinics in the first place. Secondarily, this change in direction has really begun, that is, going with more resources even into education, after the Casey decision from the Supreme Court last June. The Casey decision made it clear to Americans generally that real substantive protection for unborn children would really be constitutionally off limits. You could regulate around the edges. You could ensure that women had full informed consent, that parents weren't shut out of their minor girls' decisions. But there is no circumstance in which you can pass a law that is an obstacle to any single child's being aborted. Well, although some legal struggles will go on where they can, for instance, regarding Pennsylvania-style informed consent laws, parental involvement, essentially, we're stuck with Roe and Casey for a while. Clinton is supportive of legal abortion. What he could do to make things worse for us is to follow through on his promise to the abortion advocacy community of supporting the Freedom of Choice Act. So our first object is to ensure that the Freedom of Choice Act never gets to Mr. Clinton's desk. We think we can be successful. We stalled it last summer by raising with various congresspeople during, you know, individual lobbying, very serious moral questions in their minds about whether they truly wanted to be associated with third trimester abortions or whether they wanted to be associated with a law that specifically does not provide conscience protection for hospitals who don't want to do abortions like Catholic hospitals. We think we can raise these moral objections in the minds of congresspeople again, because neither they nor Governor Clinton, when push comes to shove, want to be associated with abortion on demand.
The Supreme Court has decided not to overturn Roe v. Wade, but it has upheld restrictions on a woman's right to abortion. When you look at the Supreme Court and you look at the Congress now, which do you see your future in?
I see our future in the Supreme Court in the long run and Congress in the short run. The Supreme Court has held essentially that no really protective laws may be passed. There is no law which may be passed which may be an obstacle to any woman's achieving an abortion for any reason. So the Supreme Court is in a very extreme position of not just allowing but constitutionally rooting abortions for any time, for any reason. In the short run, because President Clinton has agreed to a litmus test, every Supreme Court appointee must toe the line of legal abortion. In the short run, our hope is not in the Supreme Court for according any value or dignity to unborn life in the short run. In the long run, we still have to look to them, however, because Roe and Casey together ground a very extreme abortion policy.
My guest is Helen Alvarez, Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. This is the 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Noah Adams, how will you be covering that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. President Clinton has signed executive orders this afternoon that will overturn restrictions on abortion rights. We'll be covering that story. The prohibitions against fetal tissue research have been overturned as well. Also, there's an anti-abortion march in Washington, D.C. on the 20th anniversary. In other news, Mara Liasson and Anita Totenberg will be discussing the withdrawal of Zoe Baird to be Attorney General. No new names are coming immediately to light. We'll talk with a few Americans about among those who called their representative in Congress to express their views about Ms. Baird's nomination. Also, advice on saving money at home. It's the Tightwad Gazette.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're back with Helen Alvarez, Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. Do you think that the inauguration of President Clinton is energizing the anti-abortion movement?
I'm quite certain of it. Part of my job is to travel the country and speak, and in the last, just since November, I've been to about 16 states. It gives me a good opportunity to take the pulse of the nation. And I've been to 44 states in the last 2 years. What I have seen is that the numbers of people showing up at my talks are doubling. I belong to a group, Feminists for Life. I'm also part of the Susan B. Anthony Fund privately, which is a group raising money for pro-life, pro-women, women candidates. These groups are experiencing an enormous upsurge in memberships, in contributions. People are looking for something to turn their pro-life energies toward. The Catholic Church is sponsoring a letter-writing day on January 24th. We expected maybe a million people to request information from us. About 5 million did. absolutely ran out our supplies. Even if only a million of those people respond, Congress will be getting an avalanche of letters right at the beginning of their term, indicating to them not only that they should reject the Freedom of Choice Act, but that no matter what position taxpayers take, they really don't want their money or their government associated with providing abortions.
You mentioned that you're part of a movement to get pro-life women candidates elected. Is this a reaction to women who have run for office who have been pro-choice? Are you afraid that the pro-choice groups are getting the women's vote?
That isn't the case, and likely never will be. I'm working on this in my private life, not as part of my work with the church, because the statistics have shown, whether it's Life magazine, Harris polls, Gallup polls, you name it, that women are more pro-life than men. Women, however, are often disenfranchised from seeing their political stand become a reality. There are some well-funded and very well-spoken groups that get a lot of attention from the press who claim to be both feminist and support abortion. There are, however, a myriad of groups, and in fact, with larger memberships under the banner of the National Women's Coalition for Life. They've got 1.8 million members, and they're only 9 months old, who are pro-life. They are pro-women pro-life. Their stance is that you cannot denigrate the gift that women have of bearing children. You cannot denigrate pregnancy and motherhood without at the same time really implicitly asserting that women have a flaw. And we think that that's the old sexist argument, that our biology is a flaw. We rather would work for policies such as maternal leave, such as adequate child care, such as laws refuting discrimination on the basis of pregnancy, that truly accommodate women, including women with children. We note that it is only women candidates who support abortion who get a lion's share of the press.
Who are the Catholic Church's allies in its fight against abortion? And I'm wondering if you consider yourself allied with some of the more extreme groups who oppose abortion, and I mean militant.
When you say militant, are you referring to people who engage in violence?
Well, I'm referring to two things. One is that for the people who physically bar women from entering abortion clinics, mm-hmm. And also people who use smoke bombs or death threats against people who provide abortions.
No, that would be inconsistent. Our philosophy, our position undergirding everything the church does on behalf of life, whether it's patients with AIDS, the elderly, or the unborn, is the same, that no innocent life should be directly harmed. We don't believe in using violent means, even to achieving very good ends. Thereby, we oppose anything like either verbal violence or physical violence or destruction of property. We do support peaceful protests.
Do you support demonstrations in
peaceful
in which,
demonstrations, that's right.
Peaceful demonstrations which physically bar women from entering clinics?
No, they should not be physically harmed or physically interfered with. Civil disobedience, that is civil trespass, criminal trespass, that is peaceful to everyone involved, that doesn't involve physical confrontation or harm to another.
It seems that every time I turn on the TV, I see one of those Choose Life commercials.
Right.
What do you as a spokesperson for the Catholic Church think of the commercials, and is there any church money behind them, or do you plan on sponsoring a similar TV campaign?
Well, that's strictly secular private money that is behind those commercials. Those cost over $20 million a year. The pro-life movement is supported by people who have less money than those who support abortion. The more money you have demographically, the more likely you are to support legal abortion. Therefore, there isn't a group other than the DeMoss Foundation that I know of that has $20 million a year to put into those commercials. They're beautiful, and they give out a message that virtually no one disagrees with, which is that life is a beautiful choice. The Catholic Church is behind it, and we are also financially in the matter of hundreds of millions of dollars behind efforts to make it possible for women to choose life.
Has the Catholic Church written off President Clinton in terms of his abortion stand, or will you be trying to influence him to come around to see things from your perspective?
We'll be trying to influence him. This is a president who said that he's looking for change. The past 20 years have not shown abortion to solve any social problems. Rather, they've been exacerbated. If he really wants change, he will not support a continuing failed policy of abortion. This is a president who says that he wants a new ethic of mutual responsibility and that he wants abortion to be rare. We are more than happy to work with him on programs like health care and maternal and family leave and child care and poverty programs that will do away with the reasons women are seeking abortions. That would be wonderful.
Helen Alvarez is Director of Planning and Information for Pro-Life Activities at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the controversial chancellor of New York's public schools, Joseph Fernandez. He supports a multicultural curriculum that some of his schools have refused to follow. Fernandez was a high school dropout and heroin user before he fell in love with math and became an educator. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.